next case on the court's calendar is William Baxter versus Dignity Health et al., case number 65064. Mr. Logan, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
I'd like to reserve 10 minutes.
Okay. You have 15. You want to reserve 10 or do you want 5? Yeah, okay. I was thinking that might be the one you meant.
May it please the members of the court, my name is Gary Logan and I represent Mr. William Baxter. Mr. William Baxter is a 39-year-old ventilator-dependent quadriplegic and has been since 12. The complaint in this case, the complaint for medical malpractice, was dated August the 19th, 2013. It was filed on August the 19th, 2013. At approximately 1:40 p.m. The declaration of good cause from the plaintiff's expert was signed on August the 16th, 2013, and the CV to the declaration was dated August 19th, 2013. The declaration was filed on August the 20th, 2013 at approximately 9:56 a.m. So there was a period of approximately 5 hours and 15 minutes of judicial time between when the complaint was filed and when the declaration was filed. I can tell you that as far as I know, the declaration and the complaint were submitted for electronic filing on or about the 19th of 2013. I cannot tell you, because I do not know, why the declaration was filed approximately 5 hours after the complaint.
So, Mr. Logan, you're saying you attempted to file both of them simultaneously on the 19th?
As far as I know, my secretary attempted to file both of them simultaneously.
Okay.
And indeed, paragraph 30 of your complaint says plaintiff is filing at or about the time of the filing of this complaint the declaration of Joseph Cadden, MD, pursuant to NRS. So your complaint certainly internally references the affidavit.
Yes, it does. And we had the affidavit, I believe, on the 16th.
It's signed on the 16th, but the exhibit to it has...
That would be the CV?
Yes. It has an 819 notation.
That I cannot account for. But I didn't recognize that the two were not filed at or about the same time until this motion to dismiss came down.
Was the summons issued and the two documents served together in terms of serving the complaint on the defendant? So they were served as a package, the complaint, the affidavit, the summons. There's nothing in the return of service that reflects that the affidavit wasn't served with the...
No, absolutely not. And as far as I know, these documents were served on the defendants at or about the same time.
So, and do you know when the summons was issued?
I don't have that. It may be...
Don't take time away from it. Maybe when you sit down, you could look and
all
see.
Right.
And Mr. Logan, again, this is an unusual case with the facts, you know, with it, but it occurred to me that if you had realized that it hadn't been filed simultaneously, you could have done a dismissal without prejudice, a notice of dismissal and refiled it because statute of limitations wasn't up.
Right.
And you could have attached it because it wasn't up till December, you know, 4 months later. So the defense didn't even bring this up till after the statute of limitations was up. Is that correct? Yeah.
I cannot recall that, Your Honor. Because I don't know.
But you didn't have the opportunity of filing a new complaint by doing a notice of dismissal without prejudice because you weren't aware of this date discrepancy in the filing. Is that, I understand that.
I think that's fair, yes.
Okay, thank you.
But you always contemplated filing the complaint and then filing the affidavit. You had a choice. You could file the complaint with the affidavit stapled to it as all one document, or you could file the complaint and then a separately captioned affidavit.
Which we did.
But
and that
are
is
you, do you believe, is it your position that if they had been filed 1 minute apart, that you would have complied with the statute? In other words, that you can file the exhibits to a complaint separately?
Well, I've always filed them as a separate document. The declarations have their own caption, and they are filed separately from the complaint. I think it's easier for everybody if that's done than trying to physically attach an affidavit to a complaint.
Mr. Logan, but what are we to do with NRS 41A-071 that talks about if the action is filed without an affidavit?
Well, this action wasn't filed without an affidavit. The affidavit was filed approximately 5 legal hours subsequent to the time of the complaint.
Was it separately filed? Or was
yes.
It filed with the complaint?
Absolutely. I've always filed these affidavits separate from the complaint. I don't think there's anything in the statute that precludes that.
So you're debating, frankly, the statutory interpretation of the word with, whether that means attached to or a part of, would still bring you within compliance of the 41A requirement that the affidavit be provided along with the complaint.
Yes. The statute talks about an action if the action is filed without an affidavit. Well, there was an affidavit filed. It just wasn't filed simultaneously with the complaint, and the only way it could have been filed simultaneously is if the affidavit was attached to the complaint. And I will tell you, I have never attached an affidavit to the complaint. And within the last 2 years, I'm not bragging, I have settled in excess of $11 million worth of medical malpractice complaints without ever attaching the affidavit to the complaint. And no objection was ever made by defense counsel. I repeat, I do not know, and my secretary does not remember, because I quizzed her again today, why were these two documents not filed at or about the same time? And she doesn't know, other than they were electronically filed.
So So make your case for why we should read the statute to support your compliance, either literal or substantial.
Well, the statute, as I've said, according to my reading of the same, does not require that the affidavit be filed or attached. Forget about filed. Does not require that the affidavit be attached to the complaint. It says basically that the affidavit must be filed with the complaint. It doesn't say it has to be filed simultaneously. It wasn't in this case. And I've had other cases where they're not filed simultaneously.
And that's counsel's option, to file them as two separate.
Right.
Under Rule 10, you can do that.
Exactly. That's my position. And the statute, 41A.071, does not preclude that.
Well, doesn't the word with suggest that it's simultaneous? If not attached, it's within a few minutes of one another, not the next day, not a week later, not 2 months later.
But the statute doesn't say with. It says if it is submitted without. The district court shall dismiss the action without prejudice if the action is filed without an affidavit.
So how do we gauge that? Without or with? Is it, as one of my colleagues suggested, is it 2 minutes? Is it a week? Is it a month? Does it still constitute with? I mean, is the complaint originally filed without an affidavit, if not simultaneously filed?
I'm not sure I understand that question.
I thought I just heard you say that nothing in the statute requires that it be filed simultaneously. And I think that I agree with you on that. The words aren't there. But the suggestion that if a complaint is filed without the appropriate affidavit, then it is to be dismissed. So my question is, within what time period does with it apply? I mean, a week, a day, 2 minutes?
Well, certainly it has to be more than a couple of hours. And that's what it was in this case. 5 hours of judicial time. But I cannot account for why there was a delay between the filing of the complaint and the filing of the affidavit. We know there was because the documents are stamped. One is stamped on the 19th, the other is stamped on the 20th at 9 something in the morning.
Yes. That the body of the complaint refers to the exhibit as if it were filed at the very same moment.
That,
which seems to me to support your position. I mean, you're saying it wasn't filed without it in the sense of it wasn't around, it didn't exist, it wasn't forthcoming.
Right, and we had the declaration, and I made a point of saying this. We had the declaration, I believe, on the 16th.
So what do we do as a court to make a rule that makes sense here? You have the broad language in Washoe County versus Smith that says void ab initio if it's filed without the affidavit. Your point is we would infer reasonable time, and I mean, what's your reading of this statute as far as how we would write this if we were writing an opinion?
Well, I think you have to give it a reasonable interpretation.
Okay.
And we're looking at people who are seriously injured.
Yeah.
In this arena of the law.
And the statute of limitations did not run. I mean, so you
no,
don't have a relation.
The statute of limitations
back.
Did not run. Absolutely not.
See, and I'm just wondering, as far as getting contrary to the law that we've already established, and the fact that the statute of limitations hasn't run, and you can make the argument that this relates back, with our assertions that that this complaint becomes void ab initio, does that do away with that argument with the relation back.
I'm not sure I understand that question, Your Honor.
If your complaint standing alone, okay, and the declaration standing alone, they're two separate documents, and you're saying you want to save the complaint, and that would mean that the declaration would have to relate back to the complaint at some point. So it would be basically a relation back under 15B. If the complaint is void, as we've said, if it's not filed with the declaration, how does that happen?
Well, my position is that the affidavit was filed with the affidavit, or with the complaint, excuse me.
So there's no reason to have it relayed back?
I don't think so, no. Okay. I think you can rule, as a matter of law, that these two documents need not be filed at the same time, because the statute doesn't require that. And I keep coming back to the statute. It says, if the action is filed without an affidavit, the action was filed with an affidavit, the affidavit was filed 5 hours later. For what reason, I cannot tell you. I can represent to you that we had the affidavit, and it was dated, I believe, on the 13th. And these documents were filed on the 19th and 20th.
In your mind, is there any difference between an action and a complaint? I mean, they could have said...
In terms of this statute?
Yes.
No.
Okay.
So your argument, Mr. Logan, is this isn't a Rule 15 relation back argument. This is an issue where you either substantially complied or didn't substantially comply with the statute.
Exactly. And I think we did.
Yeah, I didn't have a chance to look at that annoying record. Was there any effort to develop the filing process in the clerk's office as to why there would be a separation between the electronic filing period for one document and the electronic filing period for another?
I did not get into that.
It's interesting what we would be doing with this situation had the affidavit been filed first and the complaint filed the next day. But in any event, I think we've consumed your time, Mr. Logan, and we'll ask counsel to argue now.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Ms. Blazich, how are you?
Hello. Good afternoon. May it please the Court, my name is Shirley Blazich, and I represent the Respondent Dignity Health, doing business as St. Rose Dominican Hospitals, as well as, for the purposes of the arguments today, all of the respondents collectively. I would like to begin by actually responding directly to some of the points that Mr. Logan raised in his opening statement. With regard to the electronic filing in the 8th Judicial District Court, it is my understanding that the file stamp occurs as of the time that essentially the submit button is clicked and your document disappears into the electronic world. It is not a timestamp that appears when it gets processed on the back end by the clerk's office. So the fact that the file stamps reflect two different dates appears to indicate that the documents were submitted on two different dates.
Well, if they'd been submitted on the same day but 5 hours apart, let's say the complaint was filed at 10 a.m. and 5 hours passes and it's 3:15 and it's filed at the affidavit follows. Same deal. We don't know why they came up this way. Ours is not to wonder why, but we have these stamps. Would you accept that that was filed with the complaint?
You know, Justice Pickering, I can't say whether or not that would comply with the statute. That's not the facts of the case that we...
Well, but you're asking us to interpret this statute here and to sustain a dismissal in a serious matter. So analytically?
Analytically, the statute requires dismissal if the complaint is filed without the affidavit.
So let's play with this for a moment. He files the complaint, and I have a hypothetical that it's 5 hours later, but I was going to move that 5 hours to he files the complaint and 10 minutes later. He files the declaration.
Under the plain language of the statute, that would not be sufficient, and it would not strictly comply with the statute.
So it needs to be attached, physically stapled to the complaint.
That appears
to
be...
appropriately filed.
That's your argument?
Correct. That appears to be the meaning behind the plain language of this particular statute.
But if you don't go plain language, what about the legislative history? Was there discussion before our legislature on whether it should be attached or it should be a separate
attached
document?
Is an easy word to slip into a statute.
And I don't recall ever seeing any specific legislative intent contemplating the specific situation that we have here, Justice Cherry.
Plain meaning is fine, and both parties agree it's plain meaning, but here it seems ambiguous, at least to my court, to my colleagues, it's ambiguous, somewhat ambiguous to me, so I was wondering if there was anything in legislative history where they advised lawyers, by the way, if you file this, you better attach it.
I'm not aware of anything requiring that it be attached. However, the legislative history is clear that this is meant to be a jurisdictional requirement for the complaint to proceed before the district court. And a complaint that does not strictly comply shall be dismissed.
But your reading moves into the statute. The statute says the action, if it is not filed, if the action is filed without an affidavit, it does not say... If an affidavit is not attached to the complaint, it says if the action is filed without an affidavit. So on the example of two separate filings, not physically attached, but within moments of one another, I have trouble deeming that not to be compliance with the literal wording of the statute. And I understand the complaint would have been filed without the affidavit, but the action is commenced. You file a complaint, you file the exhibits, either as an attachment or separate, you get the summons issued, you serve them. That's the commencement of an action. Now, I get that the statute says action filed. But I'm struggling to read into this statute a requirement that the affidavit be physically integrated into the complaint, particularly where the complaint cross-references the affidavit and says it's filed and relies on it. Just textually, how do you get that it has to be attached from that language?
I would agree that perhaps the word without can be interpreted two different ways. However, this Court has repeatedly held that NRS 41A is not ambiguous and that it shall be given its plain meaning. And in this case, without would tend to suggest that it must, in fact, be attached.
Doesn't it necessarily require that you examine that question in the moment in time the complaint is filed, not 10 minutes later, the next day, or 3 weeks later? You determine whether it's been filed with or without the affidavit when itself has been filed.
That is correct, Chief Justice.
Otherwise, any rule we adopt is going to allow for a sliding scale.
And that's exactly the case. This Court's repeatedly held that shall connotes mandatory language and that it is the legislature's express determination, since it employed that language, shall dismiss, instead of subject to dismissal, that a court should have no discretion in this regard and that dismissal is mandatory. In that sense, it's no different than a statute of limitations or a rule of appellate procedure that requires appeals to be filed within 30 days. It's a sharp rule, it cuts with a clean knife, and there are no exceptions to it. If exceptions were to be allowed, it would create a slippery slope, uncertainty in the law, and would foster additional litigation and additional costs and expenses, which this legislature specifically said it was contemplating when it enacted tort reform and it passed NRS 41A.071.
Counsel, how come you waited until after the statute of limitations was up to file your motion to dismiss? You probably were served with it within 120 days. Within the statute of limitations, you had that time period. Well, wasn't that gamesmanship here? I caught him by a couple hours, so we'll go ahead and wait. We'll stall on this thing until the statute's up, right?
Not at all, Justice.
It wasn't?
Not at
really?
All.
Yeah, really?
No, and I'll show you how. With the complaint being filed on, August 19th, we being Dignity Health St. Rose Hospital, filed our motion to dismiss on November 18th, 2013. So we filed it within the 20 days to respond after the time that we were served. Now, because there was a preemption filed of a pre-existing judge, the matter was transferred to another department, and that's how it came before Judge Corey. Now, the point that I think is worth making in this regard is on November 18th, 2013, when our motion to dismiss was filed, the statute of limitations had not run. And at that point, any confusion that appellant may have had with regard to the complaint and the affidavit being filed together or attached would have absolutely revealed itself to him and shown that they were filed separately and on different days. At this point, he would have had the opportunity, as the court suggests, to file a voluntary dismissal or even just to file the case again, which is ultimately what appellant ended up doing after Judge Corey dismissed the case and issued that ruling. He filed the whole action again, which was before this court on a writ of mandamus. The fact is that the statute of limitations had not passed at that point in time.
Could he have filed a voluntary dismissal once you entered a general appearance and filed your motion to dismiss, or would it require a stipulation to dismiss the case?
I believe that it would have required a stipulation to dismiss.
Okay, so he couldn't have done a voluntary dismissal, and he would have had another motion pending once you filed your motion to dismiss, so that motion would have to be resolved before he could file a separate new lawsuit, correct?
Well, that's not my understanding. I believe that he could have filed a separate lawsuit with the exact same allegations in it, and that would have just been subject to any kind of motion that the parties wanted to bring to dismiss it as cumulative or duplicative. But then at that point, had the first lawsuit been dismissed, then that second lawsuit would have been the one that had been filed within the statute of limitations that he proceeded upon.
But the second one here was outside the statute of limitations, correct?
It was, because appellant did not file it upon receiving our motion to dismiss.
Could you address Mr. Logan's substantial compliance argument? Is it your position that this statute does not allow the substantial compliance doctrine to apply?
That is our position. The doctrine of substantial compliance was not argued at the district court level, and Judge Corey never had an opportunity to respond to that type of an argument. Second of all, the doctrine of substantial compliance is a New Jersey Supreme Court decision, which is not binding on this court. However, in that decision, that court specified that substantial compliance only applies in certain situations. And the language of their particular affidavit requirement statute specified that the court at its discretion could dismiss a medical malpractice complaint. It did not use the language of our statute, which says shall dismiss. Also, with regard to substantial compliance, the New Jersey Supreme Court held that extraordinary circumstances needed to exist, and that attorney inadvertence did not constitute such an extraordinary circumstance. Mr. Logan has indicated that they were in possession of the expert affidavit, and for some reason it was filed separately. That amounts to essentially an explanation amounting to inadvertence, and that is not a circumstance that can justify this court to disregard stare decisis and carve out an exception.
Counsel, if I recall the 41A debate, it had to do with, at the time, what was referred to as frivolous medical malpractice lawsuits that were being filed with very little support. And we go back to the review panel that we used to have. But the fact of the matter was, this requirement was made to be sure that the complaint being filed was well-founded both in law and in medicine, i.e. deviation from the standard of care. Now, it's pretty clear in this case that they had their expert. They referenced it in the complaint. It's filed within 5 hours. And you heard my question about is it 5 hours, 5 days, 5 minutes. So I'm sort of being devil's advocate here. But the fact of the matter is the filing of the affidavit in this case clearly is within what was contemplated by the requirement that is now set forth in 41A. Can you agree with that?
I can't agree with that because the requirement under 41A.071 is specifically to create this exact situation similar to a statute of limitations that there is a drop-dead requirement that is non-negotiable and must be satisfied in every single case.
So my interpretation would be mechanical at best and would fly in the face of the mandatory language is what you're saying.
The mandatory language, I think, has to supersede anything, any other analysis as to substantial compliance.
It's still bothersome to me that this is referenced in paragraph 30 in the complaint very specifically that the declaration of Joseph Caden, M.D. is being filed pursuant to 41A.071 in support of the allegations set forth therein. You know, that aspect, I'd like to hear from you why that shouldn't cut against your argument. I just see that as compelling.
I understand that. Again, the
language, policy issue, as a matter of fact.
Well, despite the fact that the language of the complaint does make reference to an affidavit, that simply does not fly in the face of the statute, which has a separate if the statute wanted to require the party to have the affidavit, but require him to produce it at a later point in time, that was certainly within the purview of the Nevada legislature to state so in that statute. And they did not do that.
You could have said it needs to
be
attached.
But the allegation in the complaint is, and we have to accept the allegations as true, okay, for sake of 12b-5 practice. The allegation is plaintiff is filing at or about the time of filing this complaint, the declaration. So on its face, I guess I'm saying that I share Justice Perigo's concern with that because it's cross-referenced specifically. We have the more recent opinion by Justice Gibbons on Zohar versus I don't know the last second name, but that you read the two together, the complaint and the affidavit, and the two together can, in an appropriate case, not all cases, but can, in an appropriate case, satisfy 41071. And I realize the slippery slope argument that you're making, I'm sensitive to it, but to me, when you have the specific allegation, it's within 5 hours, the complaint alleges it was filed with the affidavit. What should we do with that? I mean, that seems very unfair to me.
Well, and you know, Justice Pickering, it's not that different from this court's ruling in the Webble case.
Yes.
And the underlying matter of Saxena. There was a 5-day delay in terms of filing the complaint and then serving an errata with the expert affidavit attached. And I believe that if we all look at our calendars, that was right around the Thanksgiving holiday, and one was filed on a Wednesday, and the other one was filed the following Monday morning. And so the same argument could be made of that situation, that it's not fair. But neither is the statute of limitations in that sense, neither
was
are...
Was it referenced in the complaint? I don't remember in that case.
I don't know if it was referenced in the complaint in that case. But the statute doesn't contemplate a reference.
The statute doesn't talk about what you say in the complaint. It talks about what's attached to the complaint.
It talks about what you do, and that is that it must be attached to the complaint, or it's void ab initio. No request was ever made in this case to amend, no motion for leave to amend, no amended answer or amended complaint.
Your position would be it can't be amended.
That appears to be the court's holding in Washoe.
But the statute, I want to correct you, does not say attached correct. To the complaint. It says filed without or with or without. So that's a little different than attached to.
That is correct. But any way we look at it, if a 5-day delay is not good enough, then a 1-day delay is not good enough. And we cannot start carving out exceptions to the plain language of NRS 41A.071. My time is up, unless there are any other questions.
Thank you. Mr. Logan, you have you had requested 5 minutes. We used most of your time, but I'll give you two to make any additional rebuttal arguments you wish to make.
Sure. I'll just address the issue of substantial compliance. Mm-hmm. And certainly there was substantial compliance here. The doctrine of substantial compliance requires a party to, number one, show lack of prejudice to the defending parties. There is absolutely no prejudice which has been visited upon any of these defendants.
On this point, Mr. Logan, I was going to ask you, the counsel says that the substantial compliance argument wasn't made to Judge Corey below. Do you recall what's your position on that?
I don't recall that, Your Honor.
Okay.
The second requirement is that a series of steps are taken to comply with the purpose of the statute. Certainly we did that here. And finally, general compliance with the purpose of the statute. And we certainly have that here. We have an affidavit from a preeminent expert who teaches at the University of Southern California Medical School. And he has concluded that there is malpractice in this case and that my client is now a ventilator-dependent quadriplegic because of that negligence. And I think justice cries out for a reversal of Judge Corey's decision. Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Logan? All right. Thank you, Mr. Logan. And Ms. Blazich, thank you very much for your arguments. The case will stand submitted.